I'm outside again today, but it's really cold, so I'm wearing a coat.
How cold is it?
It's not actually that cold. I don't know. I think it's like, it was like 8 degrees Celsius when I checked, but it's kind of windy. And if I go in the sun, then I won't be able to see the computer screen, so.
I'm like looking that up in Google because I don't know how
cold. I don't know. I don't know how many that is.
Oh, that's
maybe
cold.
Like 30 in the 30s. Is that right? Did I guess like right?
46, which is still really cold.
Oh, okay. I just got my Band Together bingo card. I'm excited.
Oh, nice. Is there anything particularly fun on there?
Gays holding hands. Almost porny, but not. Incites lust. Accurate depictions of ableism. I don't know what that would... I guess just what it says. Drinks, yeah. Smokes, squares. Crime how-to. That'll be good. Offends Christians. Crime how-to.
Crime how-to. Offends Christians. Nice. Cool. That sounds fun.
Yeah. How are you? Did you sleep at all? You were, like, on Discord until very late last night.
I did. I got maybe 4 or 5 hours of sleep. I, like, woke up literally right before I called you on this thing.
I was, like, looking at, like, all of the texts that I woke up to this morning, and I was like, I should just, like, tell her she doesn't have to wake up, except she's asleep, so telling her she doesn't have to wake up would require her being awake.
Oh, that's sweet. No, it's okay. I guess I'm always hoping that one of these days these, like, Skype calls will make me have a normal sleep schedule again.
Right. I did wake up at, like, 11, I think, this morning, which isn't really normal for me.
Yeah.
I usually make it up before then. But I have, Zoom class at 12:30, so I actually at least have to be awake for something pretty much every day.
Oh, is it every day?
It's, like, no, it's, like, Monday to Thursday, but I feel like that's enough that, like, you can't get too far off.
Yeah. Totally. I was actually thinking that it's kind of funny something. That I think Bees and I are on the same sleep schedule now.
Are you on... No, you're not on similar time zones.
No, I think...
At all?
They're like 6 hours ahead of me.
Okay.
So...
I'm really glad that we decided to just, like, not just, like, forge ahead and keep watching this show, because this is, like, completely different than I remembered. Like, I didn't really remember anything. But mostly what I remember of this episode is being like, but where's Will? What the fuck is going on? What order are all these events happening in? Who are these people?
Right.
And now that I get it, it was hilarious.
Yeah, this was a lot more fun than I remember. Because, yeah, I think the first time I was super antsy about Will coming back. And we don't actually see him very much in this season. Like, we don't see them together very much.
Yeah.
Like, ever.
But now that I, like, know what's going to happen, it's fine. I'm like, I could just... I just want everyone to have fun.
And Hannibal is having so much fun. He's having a great time.
This entire, like, motorcycle sequence, I feel like this is such a recognizable emotion of, like, yeah, I'm the coolest, I'm so great, I feel great right now, but then, like, normal people temper that with this impulse of, like, I should, like, remind myself that I'm not actually the coolest, because whenever I feel like this, I end up, you know, slipping on a banana peel and embarrassing myself in some ridiculous fashion, but it's just, like, he does not have that impulse.
Nope. And then we get this scene at this party, and I feel like this is one of those things that makes way more sense this time around, because...
Yes.
I think this is the first time I actually understood that, like, oh, okay, they're in Paris, and this is the professor whose life he steals. It's not just a random dude he kills at a party, which I think is what I thought at first.
The fact that this starts in Paris, and then there's, like, a time jump, and then they're in Florence, now makes sense. The first time it was just, like, where are they? Why are they? What are they doing?
Right.
So this is him, like, scoping out this professor whose life he's gonna steal, which, like, now that I know that that's what's happening, the entire thing just seems so ludicrously, like, not that anything is realistic, but, like, this in particular, this, like, man who clearly knows a lot of people, who is clearly, like, well-known no one in his field just gets him and his wife just get replaced with totally different people who look nothing like them.
Right? I'm hoping that maybe the professor used to work in Paris and he was going to move to Italy, and Hannibal was just like, I will be you in Italy now. Because that makes, like, slightly more sense to me than I'm just going to become this person in the city where he already lives.
Right. I mean, I got the impression that it was a pretty quick transition of, like, I don't know. Like, the only way I can rationalize this, like, is he saw that this job in Florence was open.
Yeah.
And he needed an identity that wasn't from Florence.
Right.
To, like, apply for it. So, like, maybe, like, I guess he, like, never actually went to work in Paris as Dr. Fell. It was, like, but, like, I don't think, like, academic jobs don't, like, happen. It's not like you just apply for it and you're, like, hired the next day. But it's fine.
Right. And we get to meet Anthony Dimmons.
Yes! It's a double-fisted kind of bash. And, okay, so Anthony Dimmons... And you wrote down his name, the fandom changed. What is his actual name, and what did fandom change it to?
So apparently in the script and in the show, his name is Anthony. Like, there's no H in his name.
Oh,
but
okay.
Fandom just said, fuck it, and now he's Anthony Dimmons.
I feel like that's fair in a context where, like, all of these characters are operating in, like, multiple cities and languages where, like, the convention might change between them. Although, like, he said, like, he went to Cambridge, I guess, like, doesn't seem like he's anything other than English, but yeah.
Right.
And Dimmond is, like, really not into Roman Fell.
Yeah. He's having a lot of fun, like, talking shit with Hannibal, or attempting to.
Yes. Thing, like, he's not... I don't remember what he says, like, insulting his books. This is like, blink if you agree. And I just love how willingly Hannibal buys into that dumb game. He's like, yep. Like,
right. And then Anthony is like, he's like talking about what a shitty author Roman Fell is because he writes like one book every 8 months. And he's like, it takes me 6 to 8 months to write one line. Like, buddy.
And Hannibal's like, why? Like, he's genuinely like the writing coach that we all need, who's just like, what the fuck is wrong with you that it's taking you that long? Like, I don't understand.
Right. And he's just like, poetry is hard.
Great. So yeah, Dimon should probably work on that. And then Hannibal kills Dr. Fell and just sits down to eat at his dinner table and waits for his wife to show up. It's the best.
Yeah, like, so he's just cooking in their house. I think he's cooking Roman Fell in his house.
Which, again, with my instinctive, like, oh god, I don't want to smell the liver smell through the screen.
Yeah. Unhelpful comment that I used to know someone who could do that trick with a champagne bottle and a knife.
That's really impressive.
Yeah.
Do you just, like, practice a lot with a lot of champagne bottles and swords?
I don't remember. Like, I remember there was a trick to it, but I, like, just, like... You know, splitting apples open with your hands, but I forget the actual trick
what?
To it.
I didn't know that you could split apples open with your hands either.
Yeah, I've seen people do it. Apparently it has something to do with, like, I don't know, like, the angle of it and, like, using your, like, the heels of your palms as, like, a lever to force it open, but I've tried and it doesn't actually work, so I don't know.
Okay. There was, like, a meme thing going around, like, gymnastics and martial arts Instagram about, like, taking a bottle cap off with, like, your foot while you're doing a trick, which seems like the same genre of thing.
Cool. Yeah.
Opening champagne with a sword.
I just like the phrase gymnastics and martial arts Twitter. Like, I like that
Instagram. I don't follow. I'm sure there is, like, gymnastics and martial arts Twitter, but that's pretty much all I use Instagram for.
Oh, and then we have the first of, like, many flashbacks with Abel Gideon. And I love them all so much.
Yes, and Abel Gideon is just, like, kind of playing along, but also, like, he's constantly, like, asserting the fact that, like, he has the power to not play along because there's literally nothing bad that could happen to him at this point that hasn't already happened.
Right. Yeah, it feels like he's playing along, but also kind of understandably disgruntled, because what the fuck?
What the fuck? This is not a situation anyone prepares for. And this line, this isn't cannibalism, Abel. It's only cannibalism if we're equals. I feel like that's, like, so often quoted, but I also feel like he's a tiny bit joking. Like, he means it, but also thinks he's hilarious.
And I just love, like, right after Gideon is, like, basically saying, you know, I don't have to play along. He makes this comment, like, but I shouldn't spoil the fairy tale, should I? And I feel like that's just such an accurate read on Hannibal and how he goes about life and what he generally wants.
Yeah, and, like, why people play along with it. Because it's, like, this reaction of, like, I didn't know it was possible for life to be a fairy tale like this. And then by the time they realize that it's not, it's too late.
And I feel like we both had similar reactions to the scene of Hannibal and Bedelia dancing.
I just love them, and I just want them to be happy. Like, not permanently. I just want them to have, like, a temporary good time being weird at each other and dancing antagonistically.
Yeah, and I think they actually look like they're having a good time. Or at least Hannibal looks like he's having a good time.
Yeah, but I also think this is, like, the part of it that Bedelia can kind of buy into. You know, like, she doesn't mind, like, wearing fancy dresses at parties and, like, buying wine and truffles every other day.
Yeah.
That's, like, maybe the part of the fairy tale that she's, like, bought into.
Right, like, dancing in a nice dress at a party. Which is interesting, because I feel like that's the part that Will would hate.
Right. Though I also love fic where he, like, does it and likes it.
Yeah. Also, yeah, I had the same thought of, when did Hannibal study medieval Italian?
Like, enough to, I know, like, it doesn't matter. Everyone can just do everything in this world. But, like, realistically, there are people who devote their entire lives to getting professorships like this.
Right.
Oh, and then there's this, what's this guy's name? Soliato?
Yeah.
The, like, super asshole professor who's, like, over the top. Like, I don't know, maybe people act like this in real life. I feel like usually they don't. But the extent to which he's, like, antagonistic towards Hannibal for being a foreigner, and when he says, like, oh, like, that's good, I'm not even going to try to say it in Italian, but what I assume translates to for a foreigner. Yeah. And Hannibal looks so wounded, and it's interesting because, like, this, like, in general, this show doesn't have, like, an incredibly strong sense of, like, place or history, and we don't even really talk about, like, you know, the Lithuanian castle that apparently exists until, like, halfway through the second half of the third season, but, like, I don't know, just, like, his face in that moment is so evocative of, like, all of the things that you theoretically know have happened to him before that were just, like, missing from this particular narrative. That, like, this isn't the first time that someone said that to him. And, like, we haven't seen it happen before, but suddenly we feel, like, the full weight of, like, being a foreigner absolutely everywhere.
Right. Yeah, I love that moment. And then I love Bedelia, like, trying really hard to de-escalate this situation and just seeming like she's trying really hard to prevent a murder.
Yes.
Where she's kind of, like, insistently being like, hey, let's dance. Let's get you away from him.
But then when they, I don't know why, this whole, like, when she walks off to go dance with this asshole, and then suddenly we have this, like, recitation of the sonnet where, like, the whole room falls silent, and I just, like, I don't know, this is just, like, such a cringe moment for me. Like, I can barely even watch it. I'm just like, oh god. Like, I'm sure it's lovely. I don't mean to insult his medieval Italian recitation. I don't know,
it's a weird thing to do at a party.
I think it's very weird. Which I think, I mean, I guess it's, like, another one of those things of, like, he doesn't care if he's being perceived as weird, and now it's, like, the person suit is coming off in so many more situations, including, like, I'm about to recite you a sonnet in the middle of the party, and everyone's gonna stare at me, and it'll be great.
Right.
And then Dr. and Mrs. Fell return home. And, like, it's really jarring to hear him say, I've killed hardly anybody during our residence. Because it's like, he's never said anything like that before. Like, he's never acknowledged out loud killing people.
Now he's just kind of casually acknowledging murder.
Right. But the way that he says it to her specifically almost feels like, you know, like, what are you trying to prove? Like, do you want a cookie for not killing anyone?
Right. And just the way he frames that whole conversation was really, like, funny and weird to me, because it's like he thinks her objection to him killing people is that he might not have won his university job fairly.
Where he's like, the real problem here is the academic misconduct.
Right. He's like, no, but once I killed him, I won the job on my own merits. And I'm like, I don't think that's anyone's concern.
She really doesn't care. Yeah.
Which, what does that even mean? Like, I won this job fairly once I killed the competition. Like, what?
Well, does he mean that, like, the reason the job was open was because he killed the person who had it?
I think
that was how I read that.
Right. Because...
And I guess, like, okay, I guess he killed, like, Dr. Fell, too. But I guess, like, I feel like in his mind, he, like, opened the job position and then, like, minus Dr. Fell, there were, I'm sure, like, lots of other qualified candidates competing for this position.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
And then Bedelia says something about, you know, that contentious Florentines can't resist, you know, sonnets echoing off the walls or something like that. And he says, one contentious Florentine can. And I feel like this is just, like, bringing back, like, this whole episode, I was just thinking about, like, you know, all of the quote-unquote discourse about, like, did they have sex in Italy? And, like, look, I love fic where they do, but I feel like the entire, like, everything that they say and do in this episode is, like, so carefully calibrated to be this, like, tension that specifically has not been broken in that way. And, like, it's almost funny in how he, like, the only way I can read, like, one contentious Florentine can is, like, that they're not boning, and he's, like, kind of mildly irritated about it. But that's, like, that's it. And it's just kind of hilarious for him to have that, like, I'm mildly annoyed that we're not having sex reaction in the context of this entire situation.
That's hilarious, and I love that. Yeah, I mean, I get the same feeling where it's, like, I never actually got the sense that they were having sex in Italy, and I'm not super, like, dedicated to jumping on board the idea that they did. So
yeah.
But I feel like I thought he was referring to that asshole professor.
Oh, like you thought the contentious Florentine
who
was resisting him was Soliato.
Who, like, still has a problem with him, despite him jumping through all these hoops. But I like your
thought better. Because I totally just immediately read it as, like, him saying, like, she's the contentious Florentine who, like, for some reason can still resist his charms. Can't imagine why. I mean, really, like, it's probably both. It was probably intended to be both.
Yeah, I could see that.
And then exactly like Will's, you know, every moment of cogent thought under your psychiatric care is a personal victory. I still believe I'm in conscious control of my actions. Given your history, that's a good day. And then there's this weird bath scene, which, like, this did not occur to me the first time. And, like, I don't actually know how committed I am to this interpretation. But after her saying, I still believe I'm in conscious control of my actions.
Yeah.
I actually asked myself the question this time, like, was she trying to drown herself?
Huh.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, I like that.
Maybe. I think it's, like, possible that she had a moment of, like, this would be the best option. There's no other way out of this. But I don't know if that's supported by the rest of her actions. Like, she just tried to run away, but I don't know.
Yeah, I could see it. And the first thing she took the plastic off was the booze in her old house.
So this flashback to her returning home directly after Musimono, I guess. It's like her order of operations, like, enter the house, take the plastic off of the ridiculously expensive, like, liquor in the corner, start drinking, and then discover that someone is in your house.
That seems all things considered, I feel like I understand her priorities, you know.
Right, like she really needed that drink for the scene that was to follow.
Right, for the sake of Hannibal's modesty.
Right, which I just found this entire, like, the way they shot this so funny when, like, it, the camera, like, pulls back and she's sitting on the bed and, like, her wine glass is just covering his junk. And this incredibly bizarre shot. And they talk about her trying to be his therapist, where she says, I lacked the appropriate skills to continue your therapy. And he says, I never found you to be lacking. Which is like, I never found you to be lacking is technically a nice thing to say to someone, but it has like so much venom in it.
Yeah. And I don't know that I actually noticed that the first time I watched it, that it's like, oh, he was actually really irritated that she stopped being his therapist.
Yeah, which I guess begs the question, like, I don't know, like, what did he want out of that? Like, clearly he was getting something from her.
Right.
And I'm not entirely sure that I know what it is.
I feel like I was watching this and, like, thinking, like, did he actually just want, like, good therapy? Like, I feel like that's actually what he wanted, which is kind of a weird thought to...
Maybe.
To apply to somebody who seems very, like, happy with themselves. But I guess if you see therapy as, like, a tool to, I don't know, better understand yourself and the things you do.
Right. Like, I think what she means when she says, like, I lacked the tools to continue your therapy is, like, well, you're a serial killer and I don't have the tools to, like, cure you of that, so I'm out. Which, like, I don't think that was what he was after. But, yeah, maybe you're right. And also maybe just that, like, pre-Will, she was the closest he had to, like, someone who knew him.
Yeah.
In which sense, like, I guess the idea of, like, Will being whether or not he's an appropriate substitute for her kind of makes sense. Like, did you get what you wanted from this relationship where someone really knows who you are?
Right. Or even, I guess, even just the fact that that's the way he chose to answer that question, where she's asking him, like, is Will Graham still alive? And he's like, Will Graham was not a suitable substitute for therapy. Which, like, I don't know, that makes me feel like that's, like, a sentence that anyone could theoretically say, you know, that
yeah,
a partner wasn't the cure for whatever was wrong with you. Therapy
right.
is the answer to needing therapy, not a relationship.
That's true, yeah. And then he asks, do you trust me? Well, she's literally pointing a gun at him.
But she puts the gun down.
Right, and she says not entirely, which is like, okay, that's more than I would have guessed, I guess.
Right.
And I feel like this whole thing is kind of like, you know, my first pass, I was like, well, like, she could have just shot him. Like, why did she allow herself to be, like, coerced into going to Italy and stealing these people's lives?
Right.
And I think the answer is, like, actually kind of the same as for Will. It's like, I think they do actually like each other on some level.
Oh, yeah, totally. Which is why, I mean, like, I do think there's, like, a point in Italy. I mean, she tries to leave in this episode. Like, I think there are a few points where she's like, wow, I actually hate this and don't want to do this and want to leave. But, I don't know, I feel like I never got the sense that she was, like, a hostage. Because I feel like that's one reading that I see in fandom sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think she was... She wasn't. Like, I do think she went to Italy on purpose, because she definitely could have shot him. But that was a choice she made of, like, okay, let's do this thing instead. So I feel like on some level she wanted to be there.
Yeah.
Because she did leave when she was done, right? Like, he's like, in that one episode, she just walks away.
Yeah, and I feel like the point in this episode where she tries to leave is, like, more a realization of, like, I don't know, I feel like this whole episode is, like, him playing really fast and loose with, like, even, like, maintaining their identities. And, like, if I were in her position, like, okay, she more or less trusts him not to kill her, but, like, what she really needs to trust him to do is to, like, not blow their cover, because now she's, like, involved in this thing, and so she's complicit in, like, not wanting him to be caught. So the fact that he is being, like, extremely reckless is, like, the one thing that's really threatening to her. So the point where she leaves is the point where it's, like, what the fuck is he doing with this, like, random Cambridge kid? This is gonna get us both killed. Like, I'm out.
Right.
So back to Florence. Hannibal the museum curator is such a good look. I love him.
And I love these interactions between Hannibal and Anthony Dimmons.
Yes, I really, really like Dimmons this time around.
Yeah. I think the first time I didn't really notice him beyond, what the fuck, this isn't Will, I don't like this person, but he's actually really fun.
Yeah, he's extremely fun and, like, perceptive and then also, like, quite clearly batshit insane. Because yeah. His reaction to, like, oh, this person seems to have killed my professor and assumed his identity is like, yeah, I'm down to fuck. Like,
and it's funny because I feel like the only thing wrong with him is that he isn't Will. Like, I think that's why Hannibal kills him.
Right.
Is that he's a little too much like Will, but not Will enough.
I feel like he kills him because that was, like, the whole point of, like, Bedelia. You know, like, I think he was trying to use Dimon to, like, reel Bedelia into some further sense of complicity. Like, he wanted her to tell him to kill Dimon. And she kind of does, but not, like, quite enough for his satisfaction. So I feel like killing Dimon was more of just of, like, a, what did you think was going to happen? Was this it? Like, trying to pull her in that way.
Okay. Wait, but, like, how does Bedelia tell him to kill Dimon? I feel like I missed that.
Well, like, the first time when they have dinner and then, like, Dimon leaves and she's clearly surprised and there's this moment of, like, I forget what he says, but it seems like he wants to make her say, like, you shouldn't have let him go.
Yeah.
And then she tries to run away instead of saying that.
Right.
But then the whole thing of, like, you know, are you observing or participating, and that, you know, she wanted to see what would happen with Dimon, which, like, I don't know if that's entirely true. He was kind of in charge of that whole interaction, but...
Yeah, I don't know, because I feel like... I think she expected him to kill him at that dinner, because that's what a normal person would do if you were invested in, you know, your secret not getting found out and you were a serial killer. But I don't know that I don't know. I feel like I didn't read it as, like, her wanting him to die, because her answer was to leave, right? Like,
yeah,
he gets found out, like, she sees Dimon at the lecture, and then she's, like, has her shit, and she's walking out the door right when Hannibal comes back with Dimon and, like, whacks him over the head. So,
yeah.
So, I don't know. I feel like she wasn't invested in his death if her answer was, cool, I'm leaving.
Yeah, I think she was invested in, like, them being, or, like, her being safe, which by extension is, like, them being safe. And what he really wanted from her was for her to be, like, invested in that enough to acknowledge that, like, killing him is the best course of action.
Right. Which,
I don't know.
it seems like she's not there, like, not that kind of person.
Right.
She's not Will. Also, that scene of them having dinner is great, where Dimon asks, is it that kind of party?
Yes.
And Hannibal,
oh my god,
totally be down for that kind of party. He's just checking, like,
right. I think that was one of those things, like, I missed the first time around because I was just, like, so confused about the entire thing. But it's like, he just looks at Bedelia like, do you, like, are you okay with that? And she's like, fuck no. And then he says, like, oh no, sorry, like, the wife has vetoed this threesome. Like,
right. And I love that. I love that interaction. I love that Hannibal was down for this kind of party.
Yes.
Because of course he was. Also, I strongly feel that Bedelia didn't know that Hannibal was, like, feeding her things to make, like, her taste good as meat until Anthony was like, oh, hey, that's what you finished cattle on.
Which, like, I don't even know if I necessarily believe that she, like, that her death was, like, imminent in any way. Like, I'm sure it's always a possibility, because it's always a possibility with him. But, like, I feel like it's more just of, like, a habit.
And I feel like I kind of read that as, like, a joke, or, like, Hannibal poking at Bedelia. Like, I mean, not that it's outside the realm of possibility that she might get eaten. But I feel like it was just, like, a kind of subtle jab. Like, oh, okay, you don't want to eat the meat I cook here.
Right. And Dimas Holt, like, I think one of the things I really like about him is actually, like, how open he is about, like, his own shortcomings. Like, yeah. He just says, like, about the real Lydia at this point. He doesn't realize yet that he's having dinner with people who have stolen their identities. But, like, the real Lydia Fell isn't quite bright enough to see that I'm just intimidated by Roman. And I kind of, like, I love that easy admission of, like, I'm scared. You know, I only hate this person because I'm scared of him. And some people just aren't smart enough to see that.
Yeah.
So then Dimon leaves. And, yeah, I think this exchange that happens here is, like, what kind of put, like, their whole interactions around Dimon in context, which is she says, you let him go. And he says, what would you have me do, Bedelia?
Yeah.
And it's, like, he is trying to get her to say, you should have killed him. And then she goes to her store to get her wine and truffles, right? It is truffles that she's buying?
Yeah.
Okay. And for some reason, the only thing I wrote down about this is, oh no, a bun.
Oh yeah, the dead bun.
It's like a rabbit dripping blood.
We get a flashback to the therapy session where she has killed her patient. And all I have written down is... Hey, remember that time you shoved your whole arm down some guy's throat?
Right. Okay, so she, like, yanked, like, the cause of death was her yanking out his tongue and shoving it down his throat, I guess? That's what happened?
I'm still extremely confused about what exactly killed this man. I mean, like...
Yeah, same. And, like, why, like, did he... I get, yes, I think the answer to the question of, like, did he attack her is, like, yes, because I think the scene is, like, I mean, it's exactly what he did to Abigail. Like, this wasn't self-defense, it was murder, and, like, convincing her that this, like, nebulous situation, which could be read multiple ways, is actually murder, but that he will help her set it up as being self-defense. But that actually makes me think, like, it probably was self-defense. I don't know why she ended up with her entire arm down his throat, but...
Although we see the therapy session in a later episode, and I really don't think that was self-defense. Because he's, like, freaking out.
I actually forgot about that. Does he, like, not attack her?
He didn't.
Or did he not see that bit? Okay.
It looked like he was freaking out, that he thought there was, like, something wrong with Hannibal and something wrong with her, and they were dangerous. And it looked like he had a panic attack. Where he was, like, choking. And her solution was, no, let me help you. And it ends with her shoving her arm down his throat, which was not help.
I actually completely forgot about that scene. Okay, yeah.
I think I just remember because I have always been extremely confused by what exactly happened to this patient. And that didn't make it any clearer.
Right. So I guess that does kind of... more implied that, like, he was accusing her of something or accusing Hannibal of something in a way that implicated her, and that ended with him dead.
It kind of seemed like that. Like, I don't think she meant to kill him.
Yeah.
But, you know. Which I guess is still self-defense if you massage the definition enough.
I mean, she's defending herself from true accusations, I guess.
I guess.
Like, what he's saying is, like, that, like, Hannibal is dangerous, and she's somehow involved with that and knows that, and she, I guess that's kind of what she was defending herself against, which, like, not really.
Right.
Okay. In which case, like, that's kind of, I guess that's actually unlike the scene with Abigail, which it, like, definitely mirrors, but, like, if that's the case, then, like, everything Hannibal says is pretty much true.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I think it is true, because I don't know. I feel like that was, like, a really weird thing for her to do.
Yeah, and then he says, I can help you tell the version of events you want to be told. I can help you if you ask me to.
Yep.
And then we get his lecture, where he literally stands in the middle of this, like, PowerPoint presentation, just so that he can have wings coming out of his back and the word Lucifer written above him.
That shot is so good. I love it.
It's so good. But also, like, who stands in the middle of the PowerPoint projection?
I know. I always think that must really hurt your eyes. Because, you know, if you've ever looked into a projector, those things are really bright. And he actually, Dimon shows up, and Hannibal is like, oh, hey, Why don't
right,
you
he like calls
seat?
Out him coming in late.
But yeah, I was thinking about what we were talking about last week, that I guess if you know that theoretically killing everyone is an option, like what is there? Like, yeah, I guess maybe you would play dumb games with this dead guy's TA to entertain yourself, because what is there to stress about? Like, even if he finds you out.
Right. Like, the worst thing that can happen is you kill everyone and go on the run, which you already did.
Right. So I guess, I don't know, in that way, it's like, yeah, it makes sense that he's playing weird games with this dude.
So yeah, Dimond comes up to him after the lecture and is just like super horny for the fact that Hanapolis killed his professor.
Right.
And also, so they're like walking through all of these, this like museum full of torture devices. And Dimond says the phrase, "What still slaps the clammy flab of our submissive consciousness hard enough to get our attention?"
Which, what a weird fucking phrase.
It's like the weirdest.
The clammy flab. Dude. And among other things, Anthony says to him, "We can twist ourselves into all manner of positions just to maintain appearances." Nice choice of words. Good job.
I didn't even realize that that was like what, yeah, that that was what that referred to. I did not think back to that sentence at the end of this episode. And Dimond tells him, "I'm here to help you untwist to our mutual benefit." And, like, does he have some, like, I legitimately can't tell, like, does he have an agenda that, like, is he doing something other than offering sex? Like, what does he mean by that? Or is that literally just, like, a come on? I don't know.
I couldn't tell if he was trying to, like, blackmail Hannibal. Like.
No, maybe.
I don't know.
I guess, yeah, I guess to our mutual benefit could be, like, a blackmail kind of situation, but. Feel like the terms are never really set out if so.
Right. But if he wanted anything, I feel like he just wanted to be like crime bros.
Yeah. Or like, I don't know. I don't feel like Dimond specifically even has like a hard on for crime in specific. Yeah. Like, I think his whole thing, like, you know, the 6 to 8 months to write one line of poetry, like, I think he's just looking for like experiences to write poetry about. Like, I think his entire interpretation of everything that happens to him is like, I'm having an experience. Yeah. Which is, like, actually not all that bad a way to approach life, but
right,
it's pretty bad if it leads you to this. might end with you dead. But other than that, it's right. Fine.
And I forgot that, yeah, Bedelia tries to leave in this episode, right before Hannibal and Dimond show up. She has her bag. She's walking out the door.
It must have taken her a while to pack if she, like, didn't make it.
I don't know, because, I mean, she left in the middle of his lecture, so I could see her going, I guess, I mean, where do they live? But I could see her going home and packing and then leaving.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right that I don't think her concern is her safety right now. I mean, well, it is, but I don't think it's that he might kill her. I think it's that she doesn't want to be arrested.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is, I don't know, this has always struck me as maybe the first time that we've seen Hannibal like raise his voice and just get kind of impatient in this particular way.
Yes.
Where after he says like observe or participate, and she's just kind of like, what? And he kind of raises his voice and he looks kind of frustrated, where he's like, are you in this very moment observing or participating?
Which I love as like kind of his reaction to like her refusal to be complicit in a way.
Yeah.
Because, like, he's kind of been trying to get her to, like, say, like, it would be safer to kill Dimond, so you should kill him. And, like, she won't do that. She would rather leave than do that. Mm-hmm. And then he still kind of tried, like, okay, so this, his response to her saying that she's observing is, like, extremely convoluted. And, like, yeah. He manages to twist it around into, like, convincing at least himself that, like, she is participating and she has somehow mandated this, but, like, I'm not sure that I'm convinced by that. So I feel like his frustration is, like, in response to this being, like, maybe the first time that he has, like, failed to make someone complicit in what he meant to draw them into.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think she's participating as far as the law is concerned. I mean, if she were to right. be arrested, this is, you know, being an accomplice. But I yeah. agree with you that I don't think I actually agree with his reasoning, because his reasoning is basically like, well, did you think through this and anticipate what we both might do? Like, did you see this as a likely outcome? And she says yes, and he says that's participation, but it's really not, though.
Right, like thinking about things that might happen in the future is not necessarily participating in those things.
Right, so I think you're right. Like, I feel like it is frustration that, I mean, it kind of feels like the frustration of, like, you know, a child on the playground when people aren't playing the game right according right. to the way you want it played. That, like, yeah. very childlike frustration of, like, God damn it, no, you're not doing this right. Although I do get the sense that there have been, like, failed experiments into creating murder interns. Like, I feel like that's what I've always seen Bedelia's patient that she killed as, who Hannibal referred.
Right.
Because I feel like if he knows that Hannibal is dangerous and does this, I don't know if he actually says that Hannibal tried to get him to do things, or if it's just kind of implied. But I feel yeah. like it makes sense that there would be some people who were like, whoa, nope.
Right. But I guess then that, like, then the question is like, okay, so what happens to those people? And in that case, the answer is like, he referred him to someone else whom he could, like, manipulate into being complicit with their death.
Right.
It's more like it was just deferred. Like, instead of getting this guy, he got Bedelia. So it all comes out in the wash.
Yeah, totally. And I think I just thought it was interesting that Bedelia cries a lot when murder happens in front of her. Which I feel like was interesting in light of, like, talking later seasons about having a drive yeah. to crush helpless birds and all that.
I guess I interpreted her, like, crying face more as like a that she had tried to leave and it hadn't worked.
Yeah,
like, okay. I don't actually know if it was like about the loss of life specifically. I think it was more about like the sequence of events that she had tried to exert some agency over and in some sense failed, although I think there are some ways in which she didn't fail that maybe she doesn't realize.
Yeah,
like the fact that he is frustrated about this, and but I think for her it's more of a like she thought she was gonna get away and somehow sees, because I think this whole episode she seems to be kind of thinking about it, like the whole thing of like her looking at the security cameras and just kind of walking through public spaces in yeah. a way that seems very contemplative of like, this could be my life, like I could be this anonymous person who isn't involved with this, and then when she finally makes that decision, she realizes it wasn't really hers to make.
Yeah.
Or, like, maybe it was. Like, I don't know. I'm kind of interested to the answer to the question of, like, what if she just, like, stepped over Dimon's body and, like, walked out of the apartment? Like, what would happen?
And I feel like probably nothing, because that's what she inevitably ends up doing.
Yeah. So and then I guess in that context, it's, like, her upsetness is more like an acknowledgement of the fact that she's been kind of like emotionally manipulated into staying, maybe, or like that she no longer feels capable of doing this thing, which a moment ago she had been sure she was going to be able to do.
Yeah. I think I was just thinking about it in light of the fact that like she cries after she kills that person in her office too, which I could see as, you know, a shocking thing happening to you and you don't want to get arrested.
Right.
Yeah. But I think I was just noticing like the, I don't know, the contrast between her reaction to murder and Will's, because I don't think we've ever yes. seen him cry post someone being murdered in front of him or him murdering somebody.
Yeah. I assume I was referring to Hannibal's justification as to why this was all Bedelia's fault when I wrote down, I am too drunk for this level of conniving, and I'm not even all that drunk.
And we get one last scene of Gideon and Hannibal, and I just love that line, if only that company could be Will Graham.
Yes, because Hannibal has been talking while he has all of his snails eating Gideon's arm about how they prefer eating with each other.
Right.
And Gideon says, snails aren't the only creatures that prefer to eating with company. only that company could be Will Graham. And it's like, after so long of like weird Florence shit, it feels weird for Will to even be like brought up again, at least like this time through. I'm like, oh god, Will. He's still here.
And it's interesting to like take into account that this all happens while Will is in jail. So it's like,
oh my god, I totally forgot about that.
Oh yeah, so it's during that time period when, you know, Hannibal couldn't really see Will because he had put him in jail.
Yeah, because after that he can have dinner with him all he wants.
Right, well, and then I think immediately, pretty much immediately after Will gets out of jail, Chilton finds Gideon's dead body in his house.
Yeah.
Which kind of sets this in the timeline.
Yeah. And then we get this scene of Hannibal looking sad on the train.
Yeah.
And it's so sad, and he's made an actual human heart for Will.
What a present.
Also, for some reason now, with the, like, the origami folding of the Vitruvian Man, I'm like, didn't that happen? Like, wasn't there something about the Vitruvian Man in Sherlock, too?
Oh, interesting. Probably. Wasn't there...
I feel like the Vitruvian John was, like, a thing.
That sounds really
But I don't
familiar.
Actually remember what... Yeah, I don't actually... I think it was just, like, one of those things, like a prop or something. But I don't actually remember what it meant.
Yeah.
This is going to be fun. I'm excited. I feel like I just forgot so much of this that it's, like, now I actually understand what's happening. And it's going to be great.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, now I'm looking for this fic that I was reading. Because I think I, like, texted you a few times about it. Like, this crazy amoeba fic.
Oh, yeah.
That I was reading called Precious Metals. And I was, like, reminded, actually, of it a few times this episode.
Oh,
because it's, like, this really, like, it's incredibly dense. It's, like, 11,000 words of, like, a single therapy session that is, like, very deep into the weeds of, like, facial expressions and, like, the precise meaning behind every single thing that everyone says and, like, how they fit into this, like, weird game of chess that's going on. But it's also, like, significantly about the feeling when you, like, meet someone and don't understand how they seem to have this, like, firm grasp on the world and how to deal with it that, like, you can't even imagine having. And like, I feel like most of us have probably like had that experience of meeting someone that you're just like, how do you always know what to do? Like, I don't get it. And like recognizing on some level that like that's not the case. Like, nobody actually has all of the answers like that, but still like wanting to ask them like, what's your secret? But knowing that if you did, like, A, it would be weird, and B, like, they wouldn't have one.
Right. Yeah, and I think I liked in that fic that the answer to that was pretty much just... the answer was so normal and was pretty much, I'm older than you and have more experience doing this. Which I love because it's so... I don't know, I feel like it grounds it in the real world in a way that I like in Hannibal fics sometimes. We're like, yeah, that often actually is the answer to that.
I love that. And also that it kind of like turned it around because... Oh, God. Oh.
Are you okay? What happened?
I like...
Are you okay?
I took off my jacket, but I had my headphones in, and so all of the static electricity from the jacket, like, traveled through the headphones directly into my ears.
I didn't even know that could happen. Oh, no.
Very painful. Anyway... And now I completely forget what I was going to say. Oh, yes. I think, like, that fic kind of has, like, it, like, asks two parallel questions of, like, A, the, like, how does someone do it who, like, seems like they have all the answers and they always know how to act in social situations and blah, blah, blah. And then, like, the, like, equal and opposite question of, like, how do you deal with being weird? Like, how... Like, Will kind of asks, turns it around at the end and says, like, don't you notice that people think you're fucking weird and make fun of you?
Yeah.
Which is, like, that's, like, not addressed in the show at all, but, it, like, I feel like that's actually a really interesting question. Like, how are those two things related of, like, being on some level, like, good at social interactions or, like, above other people in that area, but then also simultaneously being, like, less viewed as, like, less than or below or, like...
Yeah.
Not getting some things.
Right. And I think especially in that fic, in the context that's presented of, like, Hannibal pretty much admitting to, you know, to on some level cultivating this image of being, like, foreign and a little bit strange and a little too European to understand that some of the things he does, are strange. But he knows, and he just does it anyway because he gets more leeway if people think that maybe he's just a little foreign.
Right.
But yeah, then the flip side of that, of like, but people think you're weird and maybe laugh at you behind your back.
Yeah.
And it being that trade-off between, like, cultivating an eccentric personality and also people thinking you're fucking weird for it.
Yeah. So I feel like in a lot of ways that fic was almost like a, I don't know, kind of like fantasy of, like, what if you could go up to, like, that person, like, whoever that person has been, like, in your life, and just be like, but how do you do it? And, like, this is probably what would happen.
They'd probably be like, I don't know.
Right. Which, like, even thinking about it, like, in my own life, I know that I've, like, met people, especially, you know, like, who are younger or, like, whatever, like, known that I've met people where I'm like, wow, this person is really struggling, and, like, I probably in some respects, like, maybe I or, like, someone in my position, just, you know, like, if this is, like, in a professional context or whatever, like, maybe I am that person to them. Right. And, like, it wouldn't, like, imagine being asked that question yourself, because there probably is someone in the world who would perceive you, like, that way. And, like, that's true for everyone, that, like, everyone kind of inhabits both roles at some point. So it's kind of intuitive that the answer is, like, I'm just a person trying my best in the world.
Right. Yeah. So that was a good fic. I like that one, too.
Have you been reading any fic or just that book?
I feel like I must have read some fic, but I feel like it's all kind of been eclipsed by that book I'm reading.
Yeah, this book sounds really good. I think I might pick this up.
I'm really enjoying it. It's Starling Days by Rowan Hisayo Buchanan. It's, I don't know, it's really interesting. It's like just the story of like the first few months of marriage in this like couple's life. They're in their like early 30s and the woman is depressed. And when the book opens, it's a little unclear whether or not she just tried to kill herself. She gets picked up by cops because she's looking suspicious at the edge of a bridge at night after dropping one of her shoes down to watch it fall. And, you know, she's telling the cops, like, no, I just wanted to look. Like, I wasn't going to jump. I'm just looking. But it's kind of unclear if she was planning to jump, and it seems a little unclear even to herself. So then it just follows, like, I don't know, the next several months of her living with her depression and trying to, I don't know, navigate her relationship and her mental health. And it's really interesting and sometimes funny.
Yeah, this interview that, like, did you find this book just through this interview in the Paris Review?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, and there's, like, so many great things in this interview, and I just, like, looked it up again, and I feel like, yeah, this is, like, the kind of thing that makes me really want to read the book, because she says, like, maybe books are a record of everything I've been fascinated with for several years. I could say Starling Days begin in several places, and they would all be true. As a writer, I'm often thinking about how much language we have. In contemporary culture, there are so many words we can use to describe our identity. I could tell you that I'm mixed race, that I'm dyslexic, that I'm bisexual, and so on. Each word describes something true and important about me. At the same time, no words quite describe the feeling I get when I see a bird take off from a tree that I previously thought was empty. It's odd to be simultaneously overwhelmed by language and also to find it inadequate.
Yeah.
Which I feel like, yeah, I love that kind of approach to writing as, like, trying to navigate the space between those places.
Yeah, totally. And then there's this other, and also just, I don't know, I guess, the gaps between the parts of identity that are easy to describe to others.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, stories is a way to fill that out.
Yeah, and then often the ones that, like, have the easiest words are, like, the hardest, in a sense.
I also really loved this, the answer to, at one point, the interviewer asks her, but how do you write about a thing like the intense spirals of depression, suicidal ideation, without reproducing its harm?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, to some extent, every reader will have to decide. But for me, there's something useful about, even in fiction, describing a version of the world that feels true, that feels as flawed as the world is, with people who are as flawed as they are, but that also has the joys and beauties that are in the world. To be silent or to give a simplified version of those is a greater risk. I know that when I have struggled with something, whether it's training my dog or a deep emotional issue, when I go to read fiction or to my own writing, what I want is not perfect people, but people who have been through something or who have tried to think about a thing that I've tried to think about. Otherwise, I'm completely alone with it. And I don't know, I like that answer to the question of like, well, aren't you concerned that writing fiction about horrible things is going to promote it, of just like, well, the world is often horrible and this is a way we can all feel less alone.
Right. And like the idea of like reproducing harm being like, in a sense, like contextual, like, yeah. What does that, I think it's like kind of even just the set of assumptions behind that question that is faulty. Like, what does reproducing harm look like? What kind of harm and in what situations?
Right. And I feel like, I mean, that's the kind of question that if I saw it on Twitter, I would roll my eyes so hard because it would read as part of this, like, anti-dialogue of, you know, it's bad to write certain types of fiction. But I feel like, I guess this is what I've been appreciating about DreamWidth or, like, long-form interviews and articles like this, where it a question like that can just read as, like, a good faith engagement with the work. Of like, well, this is a really heavy book. Have you considered this? Where did you fall on this when writing it? Which is, I think, a fair question to ask, but has maybe been hijacked by, like, discourse that I don't care for.
Yes. I think that's, like, one of the worst parts about anti-discourse is that, like, suddenly, like, you can no longer ask this question. Like, the question of, like, how do you feel that your fiction fits into, like, you know, your reality or other people's reality is, like, that can no longer be assumed to be, like, a good faith invitation to conversation, which really sucks.
Right, exactly. And, I mean, you know, it's, like, the context, too, in, like, the context of this really, like, beautiful interview that's, like, very well thought out on both sides. Like, it obviously reads different than, like, some asshole right. on the internet being like, how dare you?
Right, because also, like, the point of an interview like this is to give someone that the interview thinks has something to say, the opportunity to say those things. So an extent, like, every question is kind of a leading question in that, like, even just, like, I'm sure anyone who's read the book can intuit that the author probably has something to say on, like, the right. intersection of what they write with, like, their assumptions about their reader's mental states or whatever. And, right. like, giving them the opportunity to say that is the whole point.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, giving authors the opportunity to talk about their process is not the whole point.
Right.
You know.
And I don't know. So I, like, messaged this person on Twitter and actually had, like, a very nice short conversation with them.
That's awesome.
Which is cool. Like, I love that this is, like, there are a lot of things I don't like about modern social media, but this is one of the parts I really do enjoy. That it's so easier mm-hmm. to reach out and connect with different types of people that I never would have talked to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although I do think sometimes about, like, well, like, would it be possible to do that in the past? And, like, yes, there are absolutely, like, you know, correspondences between famous authors and, like, people who happen to write them letters that they thought were insightful. And, like, right. that was totally a thing in the past.
Totally.
So I think feel like it's actually just, like, a good lesson of, like, you can... If you, like, have something to say, like, you know, in fandom there's kind of just this ethos of, like, if you like the thing that someone made, then you can go say that to them. And, like, that applies to non-fanish objects really well, too.
Yeah, totally. I think the part I appreciate about social media, at least as far as this goes, is, like, I don't know, thinking about, like, removing barriers to certain actions. Mm-hmm. Where, yeah. like, you know, the more steps a person has to take to do a thing, the less likely they are to do a thing. So, like... Email feels a lot more likely, but, like, if I lived in a time where I would have to physically write a letter and then find an address and then send it, and the author would have to do the same, I feel like a lot of these conversations would feel a lot less likely or possible. Because at some point during that chain of events, one of us would decide not to do the thing, and it would probably be me.
Maybe, but on the other hand, like, I don't actually know how I would be able to, like, predict my actions in that circumstance, right? Because, like, what are the things that would, like, prevent me from doing that? Well, like, a lot of them are distinctly modern, right? Like, if writing letters were the only way that I could communicate with someone, then, like, what would be distracting me from writing those letters?
That's true. I guess I just think about the fact that I theoretically could have contacted authors at any point in my life, but have only decided to do so when Twitter has made it easy.
Yeah. Like,
but anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm really... Summary, I've been really enjoying this book, and I'm about halfway done, like maybe three quarters of the way done.
Sweet. All right. Well, that's it for this week. If you want to talk back to us, you can probably come talk to us on Twitter, except neither of us are really using Twitter these days. You can definitely come talk to us on Dreamlit, even though, like, I say that all the time and no one ever does, because... Actually, I think partly because, like, people are just like, what is that? I'm not doing a new social media platform, which is totally fine. But I have actually been posting on Dreamlit, like, every day lately. And nice. Also using the Hannibal Fans com quite a bit, so... If anyone wants to come join that on Dreamlit, it's a thing that is happening occasionally.
Yeah, cool.
All right, see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.